This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier this week, the Army released its official history of the war in Iraq after the fall of Baghdad. The 700-page document is called On Point 2, Transition to the New Campaign. Unlike many official histories, it's both candid and critical of senior officers and civilian leaders and tries to explain how U.S. decisions contributed to the long, bloody conflict that followed. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from a military historian who worked on that project, and we'll talk with two officers who they interviewed for it, including Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez from 2003 to 2004. He was the top military officer in Iraq. If you were there, or if you want to know more about what went wrong and who was responsible, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation, where you can find a link to the report. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Pat Venditti, who may become the first full-time switch pitcher in Major League Baseball in 120 years. But first, the On Point 2 report, and we begin with General Jack Keane, who served as acting chief of staff of the Army at that time. He now works in the private sector as a defense consultant and joins us from Kuwait today, where his flight to Baghdad is delayed by a sandstorm. And General Keane, nice to have you back on the program.
Hi, it's good to hear you, Neil.
One of the things this official history says, General, is that senior officers did not step back and ask enough serious and critical questions about what to do after the fall of Baghdad. Would that include you?
Yes, it would. I think that's fair criticism. I believe when we received the plans, you know, for what we call Phase 3 of major combat operations, that's where the focus was of our attention, attempting to make sure that was right. Certainly, those plans were formulated by General Franks and his headquarters. And when he brought those to the Pentagon, I mean, obviously we had a lot of questions about it. We did spend time on it. We did not spend sufficient time on the so-called Phase 4 or stability and support operations after the major combat phase would be over. And I think it's, I know for myself, we didn't ask enough questions. And secondly, I think the senior military leaders should have considered, but we did not, the fact that the regime had an option not to surrender and could continue to fight us using irregular warfare. We never probed that. And that's unfortunate. If we had, we would not have stopped them from doing it, certainly. But we would have been better prepared when they did.
Is it part of the culture in the U.S. military then, at least, is it easy for your officers to step back and say, wait a minute, we've not thought this through, or this might be a bad idea for X, Y, or Z reasons?
Yes, it is. I mean, we do after-action reviews from every single patrol or operation that is done in combat and also in our training exercises. And certainly this report is very much a reflection, I believe, of the Army taking an introspective look at itself and asking itself some hard questions. You know, what did we get right here? What did we not get right? What could we have done better for others to follow so they can learn, you know, the valuable lessons that are inherent in it? And I think it's a positive thing in the sense that, you know, the culture is open and it's trying to get to the truth. And a lot of people are participating in trying to get to that truth. And I think that's a good thing. Certainly we've made mistakes and we're accountable for them. That's for sure. But for the sake of those who are coming after us, I think it's valuable.
I was talking mostly about questions before an action started. Your predecessor, for example, General Shinseki, came under a lot of criticism for saying that they weren't sending enough troops there. And did that make it easier or more difficult for other officers to say, wait a minute, maybe we're going about this the wrong way, or we should think about this other phase?
My judgment is that the leaders that we dealt with then and the leaders that we've been dealing with now have always been very forthright in putting forth what their views are. And certainly most of that is done in private with their civilian leaders or military chain of command, as it appropriately should be. And I don't think there's been one iota of change in that. I think the civilian leaders get get good counsel and advice from their military counterparts. And it's a shared experience, to be sure, and it's certainly based on open and honest discussions.
Our number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And William's on the line calling us from Germany.
Hello.
Hi there.
I have a brief question. I'm just someone who enjoys listening to the news and reading the news in the newspaper. I don't know, I have any special knowledge. But as someone like that, I, over the past, how many years has it been? 5, 6 years. I have the overall impression that that decision makers, policy makers in relation to Iraq somehow didn't know what they were doing when they got into this invasion. And I'll just say that globally now without going into detail, but this is the overall impression that I'm left with. And I would like to ask, did people in the military ever start getting this feeling as well?
Are you talking about
my answer off the air?
You thought, William, that this was a civilian failure rather than a military failure?
Primarily.
All right.
Yes.
General Keane, what do you think?
No, I don't agree with that. I think this is a shared relationship between the civil and military. I think it's fair criticism. You know, the Army had purged itself from its experience in the Vietnam War, in the sense that we no longer had any doctrine for counterinsurgency or regular warfare. Our officers were not educated and trained. Now, our people are very adaptable and flexible, and they're quick learners, and certainly they picked all of that up. But I do think that we were not as well prepared for this conflict as we would have liked to have been, and certainly now we're very capable at it. But nonetheless, at the time, back in 2003, is when we were transitioning from major combat operations to a counterinsurgency. That certainly was the case. And I also think that some of our strategy in dealing with it challenged us at times. And if you know the history of the United States military, you know that in most of the major wars, we've gotten off on the wrong foot at times. But as Churchill said, you know, the Americans exhaust all the alternative options, but once they figure it out, they get right to the solution. And we have figured it out, and we've gotten to the solution, fortunately, in this case.
General Keane, thanks very much for your time today, and have a safe flight to Baghdad.
Yeah, thank you very much, Neil. Good talking to you.
General Jack Keane, the former Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, with us by phone from Kuwait en route to Baghdad. Donald Wright is a military historian at the Combat Studies Institute at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. He's a civilian and one of the authors of On Point 2, Transition to the New Campaign. And he joins us now from the studios at Wheeler Audio in Kansas City, Missouri. And Donald Wright, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you for having me.
And we just mentioned briefly, official histories sometimes gloss over less flattering incidents. That doesn't seem to be the case here.
Well, let me just give you some context for the study. On Point 2, Transition to the New Campaign, was written up by a team at Fort Leavenworth as part of the Combined Arms Center. And some may know out there in the audience that Fort Leavenworth is often described as the intellectual center of the Army. It's there that historians, teachers, analysts, doctrine writers try to help the Army improve its capabilities. And I want to just echo what General Keane said. The Army has a very strong culture of introspection and self-assessment. We do after-action reviews all the time, after operations in peacetime and in wartime. And all of that is about having the Army get better, its soldiers, its units getting better, and adapting faster than the enemy when it comes to wartime. On Point 2, then, was written as an educational tool to be used in that larger introspective process. So when, as part of that process, when we first got the charge in 2005 to write On Point 2, the charge was to look at the entire conflict, to not shy away from the things that might be a little contentious, and to get to the larger story of the U.S. Army in Iraq. And that is an 18-month study. This book covers the U.S. Army in Iraq from May of 2003 to January 2005. And it's interesting that the media coverage has been relatively shallow on Point 2 because it focuses on maybe the first two months of this period that we're looking at. The overall story that we tell in On Point 2 is about an army that reinvents itself so that it can deal with conditions on the ground and deal with the things that General Keane mentioned that come up that are not as expected, by the Army when they first go into, when it first goes into Iraq. What we call that is full spectrum operations. The Army's transitioning to that, those types of operations.
Now, you mentioned a little contentious. You're critical not just of officers like General Franks, who was the commander at the time and has since retired and written his memoirs, but of people still serving in Iraq. General Odierno, for example, as the head of the 4th Infantry Division, comes in for his share of criticism for operations in northern and western Iraq during that time.
Well, it's interesting that you bring the 4th ID up, 4th Infantry Division, because in other works about Iraq written by non-military historians, the 4th ID is depicted as a unit that really used or dwelled on offensive operations to achieve its goals in the Sunni Triangle. Our book goes talks about a different aspect of the 4th ID, something that doesn't really get into the histories that have been written up to this point. And the fact is the 4th Infantry Division, just like all the other regiments and divisions in Iraq in 2003, is taking this full-spectrum approach. And that means that they're conducting reconstruction operations, governance operations, meaning that they're actually standing up Iraqi democratic institutions at the local level. They are doing some combat, but they're doing all of these other types of operations in order to engage the civilian population, try to get the support for the coalition effort.
Are you saying that the criticism of the 4th ID is heavy-handed, is misplaced?
I think it overlooks a lot of the things that the 4th ID did there. In fact, in several of the chapters of On Point 2, we brought in journal entries from a civil affairs officer, and he describes the massive reconstruction effort that begins in June of 2003. In fact, there's so much money suddenly available to reconstruction officers in Iraq at this time frame that they don't know how to spend it. Everybody's doing reconstruction at this time, and it's overwhelming. And this is in the Sunni Triangle where the 4th ID is operating.
Hmm. So, again, it does suggest a period of transition from learning about the problems that face new problems, unexpected problems, and adapting to them.
Exactly. And General Keane is right. The history of the Army is about often about improvisation, learning as we go, getting better. And that continues today. In 2008, the Army doing its operations in 2008 is not like the Army 2004. We've come a long way even from 2004.
Donald Wright, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Donald Wright, a military historian at Combat Studies Institute at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, also the co-author of On Point 2, Transition to the New Campaign. Again, you can find a link to that report on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. When we come back, we'll talk with retired Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the ground commander in Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing On Point 2, the unclassified official U.S. Army history of the war in Iraq. Its 700 pages are based on interviews conducted by military historians with many of the top officers who served in Iraq and on after-action reports. It's honest and often critical. And today we're talking with several former officers quoted in the report about lessons learned since 2003. You can find a link to the full report on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. If you are in Iraq or if you'd like to know more about what went wrong and who was responsible, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. In 2003 and 2004, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez was commander of coalition ground forces in Iraq. His new memoir is called Wiser in Battle, A Soldier's Story, and he joins us now by phone from New York City. And General Sanchez, nice to have you on the program today.
Absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity.
And have you had a chance to read On Point 2?
Well, I've started wading through it. I'm about almost 200 pages into it at this point.
And one of the things the report discusses is, there's been considerable criticism of your tenure as commander of coalition ground forces, that the insurgencies were stronger when you left than they were when you came.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with the publication of On Point 2 and with the documentation of the decisions and the initiatives that were taken that are reflected in my book, Wiser in Battle, I think we begin to get a pretty clear picture of what it is that creates these conditions for us. And I think it's clear from the facts that national, both political and military decisions are made in Washington that create some significant problems for the nation on the ground.
So your problems in Iraq were caused by military civilian leaders in Washington?
Well, what you have is you have some very critical decisions that impose significant challenges on our ability to bring about security and also on our ability to maintain continuity on the ground. as On Point 2 establishes. There are some very critical decisions that are made in the 1 May timeframe on transition of commands and staffs and the withdrawal of forces reflect an understanding or a belief at the political and the highest levels of the military hierarchy that this war is over, and in fact that hinders our ability to bring about the stability that was necessary to move forward during the summertime.
And the report, the history blame puts the blame for that on General Franks.
Well, in fact, those are decisions that are made by his level of command at that time in the April-May timeframe. But I think, our political leadership, both the Secretary of Defense and at the highest levels of the government, the President, are concurring those recommendations. And, that's the only way that we execute wars, based on the consent of our political leadership. So I think believe that there's a shared responsibility within the military leadership and the political leadership.
What did you do wrong? If you could go back and change something, what would that be?
Well, I think probably the biggest challenge that we face on the ground is that we're never really able to convince Washington that we, in fact, still have a war going on. That that realization is not, and those recommendations and judgments that we're making on the ground, it never break through until about 6 or 8 months later. By then we've pretty much lost a year. And the same thing applies with our inability to convince the higher political leadership within the Department of Defense that we have a significant problem in building of security force capacity in the country, that we have a very fractured effort. When you look at personal decisions and decisions that either happen or do not happen on the ground, I think, my book lays out about 4 or 5 different problems that we have. And in misjudgments and underestimating our enemy based on what we happen to know on the ground at that point in time, that also contribute to some of these problems, specifically against Mukhtar al-Sadr in the spring of 04. So, when you look at the conduct of a war, there's, and when you have problems, I don't think any of us would be wise in stating that that we didn't have a hand in and contribute to some of these challenges.
Your book also mentions a meeting in the Oval Office in, I think, May 2004. Secretary Rumsfeld was there, obviously the president, and you were there, and your boss, General Abizaid, was also there, and they got a memo from Paul Bremer in Baghdad saying it might have a good idea to get 2 new divisions. And apparently much of the meeting was saying, hey, wait a minute, this request comes in out of channels. The report questions why some officers didn't say, didn't ask questions at appropriate moments. Wouldn't that have been a really good time to say, well, however it came, I could really use 2 more divisions?
Well, at that point in time, you've got to put yourself in the context of the situation that has taken place at that point. By the end of May, we've got well over the number of forces, the highest level of forces that we've ever had in the country. We were right in the middle of our transition in forces. We have already extended the 1st Armored Division, which is part of the solution to handling the problem in Iraq. I mean, we've already requested the forces. They're already on the ground. We just extended them. So it was not a matter of getting additional forces from outside of the country. There were forces that we had already retained. So it's kind of a false question because we already had them there on the ground. And we had augmented the force size at the start of the problems in the spring of 2004 by keeping the 1st Armored Division and some of the other forces that were due to
rotate out. Yeah. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is John. John is calling us from Tucson, Arizona.
Yes.
Go ahead, John.
I was a scout with the 1st Marine Division during the invasion, and what I recall most about Baghdad was kind of an ambiguity, not necessarily in the entire mission, but with specific undertakings, and we often had to rely on our own judgment as far as to stop looting or to stop violence or who to protect sometimes because we weren't exactly sure the exact motivations of people in the area. And I was just wondering what the higher-ups were thinking of from their view at that time. I'll take my question and answer up here.
John, thanks for the call.
First of all, thanks for your service during that very, very difficult operation. At that point in time, you're talking the late April and May time frame, I was a division commander and moving into Baghdad, and there were no orders that were being issued to the different commands. So your description of ambiguity and difficulties and decisions being left to the tactical level, essentially down at the execution level, is exactly right on the money. And in fact, it takes us at the theater level, it takes us far too long to issue orders to protect Iraqi infrastructure and key sites. And we'd finally begin to do that towards the latter part of May.
Let's go to Donnie. Donnie with us from Orange Park in Florida.
Hi. My question is to the guest on the panel, and that is, I was in the first Gulf War, and when I was in the first Gulf War, the general orders were clear. The direction that we were going in was clear. And so my question is the panel alluded to the Center for Lessons Learned in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and that you understand what's been happening since we started the war in 2003. And knowing all this and knowing that generals are congressional appointees, and was there any time that someone could have spoken truth to power to say, what direction are we going, and why there's no clear understanding of the objective and how we get to that objective? Yeah. Because it seems to me that the war, what's happening in the war, there was just so much confusion, so much chaos, and that the direction wasn't clear. And I'll take my question.
All right, and just to spe- the generals are confirmed by Congress. The appointments are made by the executive branch. But go ahead. General Sanchez, can you answer the question?
Yeah, sure. You know what you have in the summer of 2003 is in fact this tremendous chaos that is going on because you're transitioning commands. Frank's headquarters is leaving, McKiernan's headquarters is leaving, Garner is leaving, and all those three are the headquarters that had all of the institutional foundation for the plan and for how that was going to be executed, and they're obviously the ones that have the situational awareness, if you will, about what has just recently transpired. All of that is taken away because we believe that the war is over. And in fact, this is what I mentioned earlier, is that we have a challenge, and I personally, and then General Abizaid, once he assumes command of Central Command, we have the significant challenge in convincing Washington that the war is still going on. We finally stopped the rotation of forces coming out of the country and begin to develop the strategies that will allow us to put some azimuth back into bringing stability to the country. But you still have a fractured command and control system where the Coalition Provisional Authority and Ambassador Bremer is working and not achieving unity of effort with the military, and we just are never able to really bridge that gap to have a very cohesive effort, which is another major challenge for us on the ground as leaders. Now, in fact, by the middle of the summer, late July, there is a strategy that's going on, and as the study documents, we begin to move in that direction. But there's tremendous confusion for about 60 to 90 days because of the orders that had been issued and implemented by 1 May.
General Sanchez, thanks for your time today. I know you had to duck out of a meeting to speak with us. Thanks for your time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
2003 and 2004, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez was the commander of the Coalition Ground Forces in Iraq. His book is Wiser in Battle, A Soldier's Story. Colonel Douglas McGregor retired from the Army in June 2004 after 28 years of service. He's now a consultant on the Strauss Military Reform Project. And Colonel McGregor is with us here in Studio 3A. And thanks very much for dropping by.
Thank you.
And have you had a chance to read the full report?
Well, like General Sanchez, I'm wading through this thing. It's 720 pages, and I've gotten through the first three chapters.
So you're still on the mistakes are being made and not yet to the adjustments.
Yeah, to some extent.
Yeah. As you look at the report's conclusions and about some of the critiques it does offer, and it is unusual for military history to name names, especially of officers who are still serving.
Well, perhaps, but I would not emphasize this criticism very much. It's actually quite mild. And I would argue that the magnitude of the mistakes that are mentioned was actually far greater than is admitted in the book. Far more profound consequences, such as the Odierno command in the 4th Infantry Division and the brutality that was meted out to the population, the thousands of people killed, wounded, incarcerated. That had a huge impact, and many think that he and General Swanwick in the 82nd contributed to this rebellion against the U.S. military presence that broke out in the Sunni Arab area. But I would also add that much of what's really important doesn't show up in the book at all. There is no discussion in there of why did none of the generals stand up and tell the administration point blank, the Secretary of Defense and the President, the United States Army and the United States Marine Corps are not structured for long-term occupations. They weren't built for it. We were built for effectively intervention and short-term conflict crisis resolution. No one bothers to stand up and say this. No one resigns over any of these issues. The second thing is no one bothers to point out, particularly someone like Abizaid, who has the background and the education to understand it, that Christian armies of occupation from the United States and Great Britain are not welcome in the Islamic world. There is nothing you can do to make yourself welcome in the Muslim Arab world as an occupying Christian power. It's an impossibility. He knew that. He knew that this would have the most disastrous consequences, but he folds. Everyone seems to fold at every turn, and ultimately, most of them are promoted and rewarded for folding. So it's hard.
Except
to,
General Sanchez.
Yeah, General Sanchez. And General Sanchez seems to be someone who's been picked out for particular criticism by the rest of the generals, as though this is somebody they can heap the blame on. But the truth is that the events that lead to the disaster, and by the way, things are not peachy today in Iraq. I mean, this notion that we've suddenly broken the code and gotten it right is absurd. We're paying hundreds of millions of dollars to the Sunni Arabs not to shoot at us, and right now Sadr, for his own reasons and because of Iranian influence, is not attacking us. So you got to go back to the beginning and understand that McKiernan, as this land component commander, obsesses over a war that's not going to happen. And all of his friends around him, his brother generals, reinforce this. So that's the planning focus. We arrive in Baghdad, and then no decisions are made.
We're talking about the new official U.S. Army history after the fall of Baghdad. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And that war that wasn't going to happen, you're saying, Colonel McGregor, was the battle with the Republican Guard.
Right. Well, it was they anticipated a 90-day fight to Baghdad. I actually had officers at CENTCOM tell me, well, we expect the Iraqis will be defending their homeland. There was no appreciation or understanding of Arabs or the artificial construct that is Iraq and the nature of the Arab population, which is very family and tribe and sectarian-oriented as opposed to nation-state oriented by any stretch of the imagination. So this combines to lead everybody to obsess over this war, and there was none of these officers had fought in 91. They hadn't seen the Arabs in action. They didn't know what they were dealing with, and consequently there was this fantasy that we were going to lay siege to Baghdad. And when you told them this should be over in a few days, no one would believe it. But the 3rd Infantry Division, an armor division, in 96 hours is sitting 50 miles from Baghdad and at the cost of one casualty, which is exactly what I and others had predicted. But the generals refused to accept that. So instead of looking at the probability of very rapidly moving through very light resistance and then the hard decisions that need to be made, and those decisions included the rapid restoration of the Iraqi army. There was no plan to occupy Iraq because there was no intention to do so. There was no intention to dismantle the state, dismantle the army, and then govern the place directly with U.S. military power. And again, remember, you are talking about a foreign Christian army, U.S. and British, governing directly, after the fall of Baghdad, within that 30-day period, a Muslim Arab country. Incomprehensible. Everyone who had any knowledge of the region said, this is a prescription for disaster.
Let's get Michael on the line. Michael's calling us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, I'm a daily NPR listener, and I had two questions here. One of your earlier panelists said that was talking about the compiling of information inside the Army, you know, to help try to make the Army better. And I was just wondering if there were any specific examples of past historical military events that, if we had looked at them closer, might have better prepared us when we went in, because without being controversial, the U.S. isn't exactly uneducated in the ideals of disposing, you know, a leader of a smaller country and putting in something, you know, more in tune.
Michael, I don't mean to cut you off, but let's see if we get a quick answer from Colonel McGregor.
Well, the most recent example of where you could point to some measure of success is El Salvador, where we were able to assist that government and its indigenous army in defeating a guerrilla force that was trying to overthrow it. But again, that was an indigenous army, an indigenous government that asked for our assistance, and we helped them. Very different from what we
very
did in Iraq.
Case, yeah. Michael, thanks very much for the call. We've got to go to a break. I apologize for cutting you off. Stay with us. We're going to take some more questions with Colonel McGregor when we come back about the Army's new report, its own official history. And we're also going to be talking about a strange situation in professional baseball, switch hitter and switch pitcher. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. It's Tuesday, the day we read from your emails and blog comments. Last week, right before the Supreme Court ruled against the D.C. handgun ban, we looked at who guns and therefore gun laws actually affect. For one listener, Phil in California, they've affected his whole life. 12 years ago, my 16-year-old brother discovered a gun at a friend's home which was unlocked, loaded, and barely hidden. Later, he stole that gun and used it to end his own life. 8 years later, I stumbled across a new idea in firearm safety and was so impressed that I bought the concept, patented it, and started my own manufacturing company in Fremont, California, making gun locks that are simple, safe, and swift to remove. At this year's NRA show in Kentucky, we had an average of one lock sold every 10 minutes. It proves that firearm owners are willing to take measures to make their firearms secure, which in turn keep their families and communities out of harm's way as long as it does not detract from the protection of those same loved ones. With what's going on in D.C., he continued, I can see that firearm owners could be nervous or even feel threatened that their rights or security is at risk, but until firearm owners can put a stop to fatalities from unintended discharges, gun control will always be an issue. I don't know if things would have turned out different had a gun lock been installed on the firearm that my brother had found, but the deterrent might have bought our family a little more time with the one we loved and now miss dearly. Listener Mary in San Francisco explained her feeling about guns this way. I consider myself a strong progressive, and I also support gun ownership. I do have a concealed carry license and carry a handgun in my purse and car. I also have a rifle, shotgun, and pistol in the house. Although this may sound excessive to non-gun owners, I believe I have a much better chance of fending off a bad guy than I would otherwise. I chased off two house intruders several years ago simply by aiming my shotgun at them. Nobody, especially me, got hurt. I think many people today have an irrational fear of guns themselves. I think this fear stems partially from total unfamiliarity, which can be remedied by taking a gun handling course from a reputable instructor. This is not about politics. It's about training. Guns affect everybody's lives, she continued. For a listener in Alaska, firearms are a necessity. Kathy wrote, I grew up in a family where guns were and still are a necessary tool, part of our lifestyle. A handgun is much easier to carry when we are out picking berries, where grizzly bears live, when we are fishing, where grizzly bears also fish. When we sleep in a tent, we also keep a handgun with us. If your tent is attacked by a grizzly, one of the first things he does is crush your tent with his front paws, and if you're lifting a rifle to protect yourself, it's useless. We try to get guns through private individual sales, and we feel we are our own best judge on what firearms we will own and on what we will do with them. I don't have a problem at all with restricting gun ownership for violent criminals, but the rest of us are not a threat to each other. Well-intentioned people often don't think about some communities when they talk about banning handguns. And we remember George Carlin after he died last week with comedians Margaret Cho and Louis Black. Several of you sent in your memories. Sheila in Wisconsin lamented the words she did not learn from Carlin. I memorized the 7 words back in the mid-70s, and I still know them. If only George Carlin had worked the capitals of the states into a bit, I would probably still remember them all. He'll be missed. Another young mind shaped by Carlin. Jay wrote on our blog, as a little boy, I would sneak down to the TV to watch Carlin after my bedtime. It was a true skill to remain quiet as I giggled. I tried and tried to record it with my little cassette player. I even used his football-baseball joke to write my 5th grade comparison-contrast paper. The priest bought it all the way. I hope that doesn't make me a hack. And finally, this from Noel in Pennsylvania. In 1975, my mother had a job with a long commute, which she complained about. So I saved my allowance, I was in the 7th grade, and bought her an 8-track tape of George Carlin doing live stand-up so she could listen and laugh in the car. It was also the first time I had a full stand-up show of George, and I can still hear him discussing the differences between football and baseball. Remember, in baseball, the player's always going home. My mom passed away June 21st, 2 years ago. I'm glad George can make her laugh again. We always like to hear from you, and it doesn't have to be funny. Send us your comments, questions, or corrections. The easiest way to reach us is by email at talk@npr.org or on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Please let us know where you're writing from and give us some help on how to pronounce your name. And if you want to hear shows you missed, you can find our podcasts at npr.org/talk.